Chapter 35 Mental Murder. One woe is past, and behold, another cometh quickly, and no sign shall be given thee. Revelation of Mary Baker Eddy. 1882. Mrs. Eddy's vision of a beautiful young maiden being wedded to E.J. Ahrens over her objections had been fulfilled. Because of this marriage, Mrs. Eddy had lost 3 fine students, Mr. and Mrs. Benjamin F. Atkinson and their daughter Adelma. Mr. Atkinson, a member of the Massachusetts legislature, had publicly praised Mrs. Eddy in the spring of 1879, after the barrage of adverse publicity against her and Christian Science. But the following year, all 3 Atkinsons tendered their resignation from the Christian Scientist Association, and the daughter became Ahrens' bride. It is less surprising that his character was undetected by the Atkinson family than that he was able to deceive Mrs. Eddy as long as he did. He may have been only a tool in Kennedy's hands, but he was a willing and wicked one. In the summer of 1881, Mrs. Eddy had suffered gastric pains with all the symptoms of arsenical poisoning. When she had defended herself from the poison of Ahrens' hatred, the physical effects had disappeared. From the time that Ahrens had published pages of Mrs. Eddy's writings as his own, the Eddies had felt that he must be restrained, and to that end, Gilbert had first exposed his actions in the Foreword to Science and Health. Ahrens was undeterred. He forged ahead with his malpractice, treating to help one person and to hinder another. The garment of truth is every whit whole. During the winter, while Dr. Eddy was making a thorough study of the copyright laws, and Mrs. Eddy was teaching and lecturing, they both were obliged to guard constantly against the same symptoms of arsenical poisoning. In the spring, whether it was that Ahrens' malice was bent more upon Gilbert Eddy, or that the blows aimed at the revelator fell short of their mark, due to her spirituality, wounding those nearest her, Gilbert's suffering increased alarmingly. He missed some of the sessions of the course she was teaching, but declared repeatedly that he was coping with the situation and could handle his own case. His words were more to keep from burdening his wife than a statement of fact. In every spare moment, Mary went to him, and her silent treatment gave him relief. She also asked students to work for him. One student in the May class, who had just related a story, was sent by the teacher to Dr. Eddy to repeat her experience with the hope that it would break the mesmerism affecting him. Mrs. Delia S. Manley told that as a child, she had seen a bird hypnotized by a snake. The bird circled closer and closer, calling out louder and louder. When it was nearly within the snake's striking distance, her brother had thrown a stone between them, breaking the spell and releasing the bird. Mrs. Eddy had no doubt of the cause of Gilbert's suffering, but her students had not her spiritual intuition and did not fully appreciate hers. Instead of following her lead and working diligently in the direction she indicated, they let doubts grow and began casting about, surmising other causes for Dr. Eddy's illness. Overlooking her words in Science and Health, quote, "Because disease is a belief, a latent thing of mind, before it appears as matter, we are never mistaken in our metaphysical diagnosis of disease," end quote. In the third edition of Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy had quoted from R.K. Noyes, M.D. of Lynn, in his History of Medicine for the last 4,000 years. "A drug or substance can never be called a healer of disease. There is no reason, justice, or necessity in the use of drugs in disease. I believe that this profession, this art, this misnamed knowledge of medicine is none other than a practice of fundamentally fallacious principles, impotent of good, morally wrong, and bodily hurtful." The Eddies were well acquainted with Dr. Noyes and his associate, Dr. Eastman. Both Mr. and Mrs. Eddy had taken a course in obstetrics from Dr. Noyes and been certified before leaving Lynn. Although the course of her college was not to follow her recently printed prospectus, it would appear that she endeavored briefly to align Christian Science with general medical practice. The 1882 prospectus for the Massachusetts Metaphysical College read, "Mary B. G. Eddy, Professor of Obstetrics, Metaphysics, and Christian Science. Rufus King Noyes, M.D., formerly resident surgeon of the Boston City Hospital, Professor of Surgery and Accouchement. Charles J. Eastman, M.D., Professor of Medical Jurisprudence." Mrs. Eddy taught the metaphysical, never the physical aspect of obstetrics. Science and Health then said, quote, "The obstetrics of metaphysics is its highest branch and one with which teacher and student should be familiar," end quote. Mind so changed the direction of her experience that the two gentlemen listed never taught at all in her college. But in May of 1882, she called them to examine Dr. Eddy and substantiate her diagnosis. The substantiation was only partial and of very little, if any, help in convincing her students of the correctness of her analysis. On the 2nd of June, Dr. Eddy felt much improved, and he and Julia Bartlett went out for a streetcar ride, which he enjoyed as a pleasant change. Hanover Smith and another student were with him that night as he rested in his chair, finding it more comfortable than his bed. After he had been quiet for some time, they went to him and found that he was gone. At a later date, Mrs. Eddy was able to write, "In 1882, he passed away with a smile of peace and love, resting on his serene countenance. Quote, mark the perfect man, and behold the upright, for the end of that man is peace." End quote. But in 1882, in the wee small hours of June 3rd, Mrs. Eddy was grief-stricken. The students, including Dr. Eddy, had not comprehended her instructions sufficiently to resist vigorously malicious mesmerism. Her words to Clara Choate had never been more graphic. Quote, "This is the whole of the disaster in all cases. that my students will not accept in time my advice." End quote. Even in her grief, she saw the situation clearly and knew that she must leave a record for future generations to study, that they might understand what her present students could not fathom. The first thing she did on the morning of June 3rd was to send Hanover Smith to deliver a message to Edward Ahrens, who lived nearby. She wrote of this: "After the death of my husband, Dr. Eddie, I sent for one of the mental malpractitioners to come and look on his calm, dear face. The messenger, who stood at the door and delivered my request, said that on hearing it, he grew deadly pale and clutched at the door to stand. He never came." Next, she wrote to Benjamin F. Atkinson, Ahrens' father-in-law: "With the cold form of my beloved husband lying on his bier in my desolated home, I appeal to you once more, and if you are not darkened to the sense of the awful crimes, I know you will stop them by every influence in your power. I have power to discern the cause of his death, and what I say the future will declare, namely, that Edward J. Ahrens has caused the death of my husband in connection with his co-operators, so far as I can clearly discern in my diagnosis of the case." Her work of June 3rd was not finished. She next sent for a reporter from the Boston Globe, whose account of her story appeared the next day with the caption, "Mesmerism or Arsenic? A Strange Claim by Mrs. Eddy Regarding Her Husband's Death." Mrs. Mary B. Glover Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, sent for a reporter to come to the Metaphysical College, 569 Columbus Avenue, yesterday. She wished to make a statement. Mr. Eddy, her husband, had died that morning, and she appeared much overcome at the event, and could scarcely control herself enough to make the following statement. Her husband, she said, had died with every symptom of arsenical poisoning. Both he and she knew it to be the result of a malicious mesmeric influence exerted over his mind by certain parties here in Boston who had sworn to injure them. She had formerly had the same symptoms of arsenical poison herself, and it was some time before she discovered it to be the mesmeric work of an enemy. Soon after her marriage, her husband began to manifest the same symptoms and had since shown them from time to time, but was, with her help, always able to overcome them. A few weeks ago, she observed that he did not look well, and when questioned, he said that he was unable to get the idea of this arsenical poison out of his mind. He had been steadily growing worse ever since, but still had hoped to overcome the trouble until the last. After the death, the body had turned black. The next day was no easier for Mrs. Eddy. The students expected her to bear up serenely and unflinchingly, whatever the calamity. Meeting Delia Manley alone in the hallway, Mrs. Eddy put her head on this student's shoulder and wept, saying, quote, "I feel that there is something in your heart that will understand what is in mine." End quote. Doctors Noyes and Eastman performed an autopsy and found no trace of poison in the body. This showed that mesmeric poison could produce the same result as material poison without the telltale evidence. But for the neophytes in metaphysics, it further confused the issue. The teacher had to substantiate further the facts for the scientists of the future, who could follow her mental lead. So once more, she called in reporters, this time from the Boston Post, the Herald, and the Journal. The most detailed account appeared in the Post. My husband's death was caused by malicious mesmerism. Dr. C.J. Eastman, who attended the case after it had taken an alarming turn, declares the symptoms to be the same as those of arsenical poisoning. On the other hand, Dr. Rufus K. Noyes, late of the City Hospital, who held an autopsy over the body today, affirms that the corpse is free from all material poison, although Dr. Eastman still holds to his original belief. I know it was poison that killed him, not material poison, but mesmeric poison. My husband was in uniform health and but seldom complained of any kind of ailment. During this brief illness, just preceding his death, his continual cry was, quote, only relieve me of this continual suggestion through the mind of poison, and I will recover, end quote. It is well known that by constantly dwelling upon any subject in thought, finally comes the poison of belief through the whole system. I never saw a more self-possessed man than dear Dr. Eddy was. He said to Dr. Eastman when he was finally called to attend him, quote, my case is nothing that I cannot attend to myself, although to me it acts the same as poison and seems to pervade my whole system just as that would. End quote. This is not the first case known of where death has occurred from what appeared to be poison and was so declared by the attending physician, but in which the body, on being thoroughly examined by an autopsy, was shown to possess no signs of material poison. There was such a case in New York. Everyone at first declared poison to have been the cause of death, as the symptoms were all there. But an autopsy contradicted the belief, and it was shown that the victim had had no opportunity for procuring poison. I afterwards learned that she had been very active in advocating the merits of our college. Oh, isn't it terrible that this fiend of malpractice is in the land. The only remedy that is effectual in meeting this terrible power possessed by the evil-minded is to counteract it by the same method that I use in counteracting poison. They require the same remedy. Circumstances debarred me from taking hold of my husband's case. He declared himself perfectly capable of carrying himself through, and I was so entirely absorbed in business that I permitted him to try, and when I awakened to the danger, it was too late. I have cured worse cases before, but took hold of them in time. I don't think that Dr. Carpenter had anything to do with my husband's death, but I do believe it was the rejected students. Students who were turned away from our college because of their unworthiness and immorality. Today, I sent for one of the students, whom my husband had helped liberally and given money, not knowing how unworthy he was. I wished him to come, that I might prove to him how, by metaphysics, I could show the cause of my husband's death. He was as pale as a ghost when he came to the door and refused to enter or to believe that I knew what caused his death. Within half an hour after he left, I felt the same attack that my husband felt, the same that caused his death. I instantly gave myself the same treatment that I would use in a case of arsenical poisoning, and so I recovered, just the same as I could have caused my husband to recover had I taken the case in time. After a certain amount of mesmeric poison has been administered, it cannot be averted. No power of mind can resist it. It must be met with resistive action of the mind at the start, which will counteract it. We all know that disease of any kind cannot reach the body except through the mind, and that if the mind is cured, the disease is soon relieved. Only a few days ago, I disposed of a tumor in 24 hours that the doctors had said must be removed by the knife. I changed the course of the mind to counteract the effect of the disease. This proves the myth of matter. Mesmerism will make an apple burn the hand so that the child will cry. My husband never spoke of death as something we were to meet, but only as a phase of mortal belief. I do believe in God's supremacy over error, and this gives me peace. I do believe and have been told that there is a price set upon my head. One of my students, a malpractitioner, has been heard to say that he would follow us to the grave. He has already reached my husband. While my husband and I were in Washington and Philadelphia last winter, we were obliged to guard against poison, the same symptoms apparent at my husband's death, constantly attending us. And yet the one who was planning the evil against us was in Boston the whole time. Today, a lady, active in forwarding the good of our college, told me that she had been troubled almost constantly with arsenical poison symptoms and is now treating them constantly as I directed her. 3 days ago, one of my patients died, and the doctor said he died from arsenic, and yet there were no material symptoms of poison. The reporter may not have been accurate in all his details, but the message for the metaphysician of today is unmistakable. In that day, however, the only students interested in learning from the details were the malpractitioners. Arons seemed to have a fascination with arsenic, which even penetrated to his writings. Midst the muddle of correct and incorrect metaphysical questions and answers in his next pamphlet, these two questions appeared. Question 12. Is it arsenic that kills? Question 13. In what way is mind the cause of death, which is said to be produced by poison? A year later, he was still pursuing the subject and wrote, quote, "It is said that arsenic kills, but it would be very difficult for anyone to prove how it kills, since persons have had all the symptoms of arsenic poisoning without having taken any arsenic." End quote. Quote, "Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." End quote. In her reminiscences, Mrs. Manley wrote that, quote, "Mr. Eddy was a dear, courteous, gentle character, and it seemed as though he couldn't conceive of anyone doing him any injury." End quote. With a peaceful smile on his face, he passed away quietly in his sleep. Ahrens, on the other hand, had his own wicked thoughts to reap. If he had been the student of metaphysics that he professed to be, he would have heeded Mrs. Eddy's words about malpractitioners in the third edition of Science and Health. They should have feared for their own lives in their attempts to kill us. God is supreme, and the penalties of their sins they cannot escape. On the same page of the third edition, Mrs. Eddy also said, "Since God has shown us our way in Christian healing, our mind often heals involuntarily. The malpractitioners know this, and many a time have asked us about their patients to direct our thoughts to them, knowing the benefit therefrom." Even with all the malpractice and its dire effects, this was the first case Mrs. Eddy had lost since her discovery of science 16 years earlier. This loss caused her to make one important change. She ceased working metaphysically for her second student, Richard Kennedy. Several years later, she told a class not to labor indefinitely with a chronic sinner, as she had done. According to notes of students in that class, she, Mrs. Eddy, had labored with a chronic sin in a student for 10 years. It would have been better for him had she ceased her endeavors at the end of 3 years. One should never interfere with God's methods. The sin is the sinner and brings its own suffering. If the sinner will not give up the sin, do not interfere with the penalty. The orthodox hell would be none too hot or too long for one who attempts willfully to defile the truth or to lead others astray. Quote, "God will make the wrath of man to praise him." End quote. By the 5th of June, the hardest tasks of this heart-rending ordeal were behind her. At the funeral service conducted by a Unitarian minister for Dr. Eddy, Mrs. Eddy joined in singing, "Nearer, My God, to Thee." Her voice was clear and sweet, and to the students, she seemed uplifted above the sense of death. Alone in her chamber, her thoughts went back to previous partings and griefs. The poignancy of the present situation was not unlike that of her experiences in 1849, and her thoughts dwelt upon her loved mother, as well as dear, dear Gilbert. In her journal, she wrote, "Meeting of my departed mother and husband. Joy for thee, happy friend. Thy bark hath passed the dangerous sea, and safely moored at last beyond rough foam. soft gales celestial, in sweet music bore, mortal emancipate for this far shore, thee to thy home. You've traveled long and far from mortal joys, to soul's diviner sense that spurns such toys. Brave wanderer lone, now see thy ever self, life never fled. Man is not mortal, never of the dead, the dark unknown. When hope soared high and joy was eagle-plumed, her pinions drooped, the flesh was weak and doomed to pass away. But radiant hopes around thy death couch spread, majestic forms and rainbow glories shed o'er life's long day. Intensely grand and glorious this sphere, beyond the shadow infinite appear life, love divine. Here mortal yearnings come, but all are stilled, and home where peace is won and hearts are filled, thine, ever thine. Bearest thou no tidings from our loved on earth, the toiler tireless for truth's new birth, earth's unbeguiled. Our joy is gathered from a parting sigh. This hour looks on that heart with pitying eye. What of my child? We parted in death's dream. I woke to life. She deemed I died and could not know the strife it was to fill, that waking with a love that steady turns to God, a hope that ever upward yearns, bowed to his will. Years had passed o'er thy broken household band, when angels beckoned me to this bright land, with thee to meet. She that is left bent o'er my chilling brow, rears the sad marble to my memory now, in lone retreat. By the remembrance of her earthly life and parting prayer, I only know my wife, thy child shall come, where farewell's cloud not o'er our ransomed rest, hither to reap with all the crowned and blessed of bliss the sum. When soul's rapt sense the heart strings gently sweep, with hope divinely fair, the high and deep to call her home, she shall mount upward unto purer skies. We shall be waiting in what glad surprise our spirits own.